When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Section 5 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 6, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Confessions of a Fair Saint, Continuation. Having so long prepared myself in silence, these debates were rather pleasant than vexatious to me. I gave vent to my soul. I felt the whole worth of my determination. I yielded not a hair's breadth, and those to whom I owed no filial respect were sharply handled and dispatched. In the family I soon prevailed. My mother from her youth had entertained these sentiments, though in her they had never reached maturity, for no necessity had pressed upon her, and exalted her courage to achieve her purpose. She rejoiced in beholding her silent wishes fulfilled through me. My younger sisters seemed to join themselves with me. The second was attentive and quiet. Our aunt had the most to object. The arguments which she employed appeared to her irrefragable, and they were irrefragable, being altogether commonplace. At last I was obliged to show her that she had no voice in the affair in any sense, and after this she seldom signified that she persisted in her views. She was indeed the only person that observed this transaction close at hand, without in some degree experiencing its influence. I do not calumniate her when I say that she had no character and the most limited ideas. My father had acted altogether in his own way. He spoke not much, but often, with me on the matter. His arguments were rational, and being his arguments, they could not be impugned. It was only the deep feeling of my right that gave me strength to dispute against him. But the scenes soon changed. I was forced to make appeal to his heart. Straitened by his understanding, I came out with the most pathetic pleadings. I gave free course to my tongue and to my tears. I showed him how much I loved Narcisse, how much constraint I had for 2 years been enduring, how certain I was of being in the right, that I was ready to testify that certainty by the loss of my beloved bridegroom and prospective happiness, nay, if it were necessary, by the loss of all that I possessed on earth, that I would rather leave my native country, my parents and my friends, and beg my bread in foreign lands than act against these dictates of my conscience. He concealed his emotion. He said nothing on the subject for a while, and at last he openly declared in my favour. During all this time Narcisse forbore to visit us, and my father now gave up the weekly club where he was used to meet him. The business made a noise at court and in the town. People talked about it, as is common in such cases, which the public takes a vehement interest in, because its sentence has usurped an influence on the resolutions of weak minds. I knew enough about the world to understand that one's conduct is often censured by the very persons who would have advised it, had one consulted them. And independently of this, with my internal composure, I should have looked on all such transitory speculations just as if they had not been. On the other hand, I hindered not myself from yielding to my inclination for Narcisse. To me he had become invisible, and to him my feelings had not altered. I loved him tenderly, as it were anew, and much more steadfastly than before. If he chose to leave my conscience undisturbed, then I was his. Wanting this condition, I would have refused a kingdom with him. For several months I bore these feelings and these thoughts about with me, and finding at last that I was calm and strong enough to go peacefully and firmly to work, I wrote him a polite but not a tender note, inquiring why he never came to see me. As I knew his manner of avoiding to explain himself in little matters, but of silently doing what seemed good to him, I purposely urged him in the present instance. I got a long and, as it seemed to me, pitiful reply, in vague style and unmeaning phrases, stating that, without a better place, he could not fix himself and offer me his hand, that I best knew how hard it had fared with him hitherto, that as he was afraid lest a fruitless intercourse, so long continued, might prove hurtful to my reputation, I would give him leave to continue at his present distance. So soon as it was in his power to make me happy, he would look upon the word which he had given me as sacred. I answered him on the spot that as our intercourse was known to all the world, it might perhaps be rather late to spare my reputation, for which at any rate my conscience and my innocence were the surest pledges. However, that I hereby freely gave him back his word, and hoped the change would prove a happy one for him. The same hour I received a short reply, which was in all essential particulars entirely synonymous with the first. He adhered to his former statement that so soon as he obtained a situation, he would ask me if I pleased to share his fortune with him. This I interpreted as meaning simply nothing. I signified to my relations and acquaintances that the affair was altogether settled, and it was so, in fact. Having, 9 months afterward, obtained the much-desired preferment, he offered me his hand, but under the condition that, as the wife of a man who must keep house like other people, I should alter my opinions. I returned him many thanks, and hastened with my heart and mind away from this transaction, as one hastens from the playhouse when the curtain falls. And as he, a short time afterward, had found a rich and advantageous match, a thing now easy for him, and as I now knew him to be happy in the way he liked, my own tranquillity was quite complete. I must not pass in silence the fact that several times before he got a place, and after it, there were respectable proposals made to me, which, however, I declined without the smallest hesitation, much as my father and my mother could have wished for more compliance on my part. At length, after a stormy March and April, the loveliest May weather seemed to be allotted me. With good health I enjoyed an indescribable composure of mind. Look around me as I pleased, my loss appeared a gain to me. Young and full of sensibility, I thought the universe a thousand times more beautiful than formerly, when I required to have society and play, that in the fair garden tedium might not overtake me. And now, as I did not conceal my piety, I likewise took heart to own my love for the sciences and arts. I drew, painted, read, and found enough of people to support me. Instead of the great world which I had left, or rather which had left me, a smaller one formed about me, which was infinitely richer and more entertaining. I had a turn for social life, and I do not deny that on giving up my old acquaintances I trembled at the thought of solitude. I now found myself abundantly, perhaps excessively, indemnified. My acquaintances ere long were very numerous, not at home only, but likewise among people at a distance. My story had been noised abroad, and many persons felt a curiosity to see the woman who had valued God above her bridegroom. There was a certain pious tone to be observed at that time generally over Germany. In the families of several counts and princes, a care for the welfare of the soul had been awakened. Nor were there wanting noblemen who showed a like attention, while in the inferior classes sentiments of this kind were diffused on every side. The noble family whom I mentioned above now drew me nearer to them. They had in the meanwhile gathered strength, several of their relations having settled in the town. These estimable persons courted my familiarity as I did theirs. They had high connections. I became acquainted in their house with a great part of the princes, counts, and lords of the empire. My sentiments were not concealed from any one. They might be honoured or be tolerated. I obtained my object. None attacked me. There was yet another way by which I was again led back into the world. About this period a stepbrother of my father, who till now had never visited the house except in passing, stayed with us for a considerable time. He had left the service of his court, where he enjoyed great influence and honour, simply because all matters were not managed quite according to his mind. His intellect was just, his character was rigid. In these points he was very like my father, only the latter had withal a certain touch of softness, which enabled him with greater ease to yield a little in affairs, and though not to do, yet to permit, some things against his own conviction, and then to evaporate his anger at them, either in silence by himself or in confidence amid his family. My uncle was a great deal younger, and his independence of spirit had been favoured by his outward circumstances. His mother had been very rich, and he still had large possessions to expect from her near and distant relatives, so he needed no foreign increase, whereas my father, with his moderate fortune, was bound to his place by the consideration of his salary. My uncle had become still more unbending from domestic sufferings. He had early lost an amiable wife and a hopeful son, and from that time he appeared to wish to push away from him everything that did not hang upon his individual will. In our family it was whispered now and then with some complacency that probably he would not wed again, and so we children might anticipate inheriting his fortune. I paid small regard to this, but the demeanour of the rest was not a little modified by their hopes. In his own imperturbable firmness of character, my uncle had grown into the habit of never contradicting anyone in conversation. On the other hand, he listened with a friendly air to everyone's opinion, and would himself elucidate and strengthen it by instances and reasons of his own. All who did not know him fancied that he thought as they did, for he was possessed of a preponderating intellect, and could transport himself into the mental state of any man, and imitate his manner of conceiving. With me he did not prosper quite so well, for here the question was about emotions, of which he had not any glimpse. And with whatever tolerance and sympathy and rationality he spoke about my sentiments, it was palpable to me that he had not the slightest notion of what formed the ground of all my conduct. With all his secrecy, we by and by found out the aim of his unusual stay with us. He had, as we at length discovered, cast his eyes upon our youngest sister, with the view of giving her in marriage and rendering her happy as he pleased. And certainly, considering her personal and mental attractions, particularly when a handsome fortune was laid into the scale along with them, she might pretend to the first matches. His feelings towards me he likewise showed us pantomimically, by procuring me a post of canoness, the income of which I very soon began to draw. My sister was not so contented with his care as I. She now disclosed to me a tender secret, which hitherto she had very wisely kept back, fearing, as in truth it happened, that I would by all means counsel her against connection with a man who was not suited to her. I did my utmost, and succeeded. The purpose of my uncle was too serious and too distinct. The prospect for my sister, with her worldly views, was too delightful to be thwarted by a passion which her own understanding disapproved. She mustered force to give it up. On her ceasing to resist the gentle guidance of my uncle, the foundation of his plan was quickly laid. She was appointed maid of honour at a neighbouring court, where he could commit her to the oversight and the instructions of a lady, his friend, who presided there as governess with great applause. I accompanied her to the place of her new abode. Both of us had reason to be satisfied with the reception we met with, and frequently I could not help, in secret, smiling at the character which now as canoness, as young and pious canoness, I was enacting in the world. In earlier times a situation such as this would have confused me dreadfully, perhaps have turned my head. But now, in the midst of all the splendours that surrounded me, I felt extremely cool. With great quietness I let them frizzle me, and deck me out for hours, and thought no more of it than that my place required me to wear that gala livery. In the thronged saloons I spoke with all and each, though no shape or character among them made any impression on me. On returning to my house, nearly all the feeling I brought back with me was that of tired limbs. Yet my understanding drew advantage from the multitude of persons whom I saw, and I became acquainted with some ladies, patterns of every virtue, of a noble and good demeanour, particularly with the governess under whom my sister was to have the happiness of being formed. At my return, however, the consequences of this journey in regard to health were found to be less favourable. With the greatest temperance, the strictest diet, I had not been, as I used to be, completely mistress of my time and strength. Food, motion, rising and going to sleep, dressing and visiting, had not depended, as at home, on my own conveniency and will. In the circle of social life you cannot stop without a breach of courtesy. All that was needful I had willingly performed, because I looked upon it as my duty, because I knew that it would soon be over, and because I felt myself completely healthy. Yet this unusual, restless life must have had more effect upon me than I was aware of. Scarcely had I reached home, and cheered my parents with a comfortable narrative, when I was attacked by a hemorrhage, which, although it did not prove dangerous or lasting, yet left a weakness after it, perceptible for many a day. Here, then, I had another lesson to repeat. I did it joyfully. Nothing bound me to the world, and I was convinced that here the true good was never to be found. So I waited in the cheerfulest and meekest state, and after having abdicated life, I was retained in it. A new trial was awaiting me. My mother took a painful and oppressive ailment, which she had to bear 5 years before she paid the debt of nature. All this time we were sharply proved. Often when her terror grew too strong, she would have us all summoned, in the night, to her bed, that so at least she might be busied, if not bettered, by our presence. The load grew heavier, nay, scarcely to be borne, when my father too became unwell. From his youth he had frequently had violent headaches, which, however, at longest never used to last beyond 6 and 30 hours. But now they were continual, and when they mounted to a high degree of pain, his moanings tore my very heart. It was in these tempestuous seasons that I chiefly felt my bodily weakness, because it kept me from my holiest and dearest duties, or rendered the performance of them hard to an extreme degree. It was now that I could try whether the path which I had chosen was the path of fantasy or truth, whether I had merely thought as others showed me, or the object of my trust had a reality. To my unspeakable support I always found the latter. The straight direction of my heart to God, the fellowship of the beloved ones, I had sought and found, and this was what made all things light to me. As a traveller in the dark, my soul, when all was pressing on me from without, hastened to the place of refuge, and never did it return empty. In later times, some champions of religion, who seemed to be animated more by zeal than feeling for it, have required of their brethren to produce examples of prayers actually heard, apparently as wishing to have seal and signature, that so they might proceed juridically in the matter. How unknown must the true feeling be to these persons? How few real experiences can they themselves have made? I can say that I never returned empty when in straits and oppression I called on God. This is saying infinitely much. More I must not and cannot say. Important as each experience was at the critical moment for myself, the recital of them would be flat, improbable, and insignificant, were I to specify the separate cases. Happy was I that 1,000 little incidents in combination proved, as clearly as the drawing of my breath proved me to be living, that I was not without God in the world. He was near to me, I was before him. This is what, with a diligent avoidance of all theological systematic terms, I can with the greatest truth declare. Much do I wish that in those times too I had been entirely without system. But which of us arrives early at the happiness of being conscious of his individual self, in its own pure combination, without extraneous forms? I was in earnest with religion. I timidly trusted in the judgments of others. I entirely gave in to the Hallian system of conversion, but my nature would by no means tally with it. According to this scheme of doctrine, the alteration of the heart must begin with a deep terror on account of sin. The heart in this agony must recognize, in a less or greater degree, the punishment which it has merited, must get a foretaste of hell, and so embitter the delight of sin. At last it feels a very palpable assurance of grace, which, however, in its progress often fades away, and must again be sought with earnest prayer. Of all this, no jot or tittle happened with me. When I sought God sincerely, he let himself be found of me, and did not reproach me about bygone things. On looking back, I saw well enough where I had been unworthy, where I still was so. But the confession of my faults was altogether without terror. Not for a moment did the fear of hell occur to me. Nay, the very notion of a wicked spirit, and a place of punishment and torment after death, could nowise gain admission into the circle of my thoughts. I considered the men who lived without God, whose hearts were shut against the trust in and the love of the invisible, as already so unhappy that a hell and external pains appeared to promise rather an alleviation than an increase of their misery. I had but to look upon the persons in this world who in their breasts gave scope to hateful feelings, who hardened their hearts against the good of whatever kind, and strove to force the evil on themselves and others, who shut their eyes by day, that so they might deny the shining of the sun. How unutterably wretched did these persons seem to me! Who could have formed a hell to make their situation worse? This mood of mind continued in me without change for 50 years. It maintained itself through many trials, even at the moving deathbed of my beloved mother. I was frank enough on this occasion not to hide my comfortable frame of mind from certain pious but rigorously orthodox people, and I had to suffer many a friendly admonition on that score. They reckoned they were just in season, for explaining with what earnestness one should be diligent to lay a right foundation in the days of health and youth. In earnestness I, too, determined not to fail. For the moment I allowed myself to be convinced, and fain would I have grown for life distressed and full of fears. But what was my surprise on finding that I absolutely could not? When I thought of God, I was cheerful and contented. Even at the painful end of my dear mother, I did not shudder at the thought of death. Yet I learned many and far other things than my uncalled teachers thought of in these solemn hours. By degrees I grew to doubt the dictates of so many famous people, and retained my own sentiments in silence. A certain lady of my friends, to whom I had at first disclosed too much, insisted always on interfering with my business. Of her, too, I was obliged to rid myself. I at last firmly told her that she might spare herself this labour, as I did not need her counsel, that I knew my God, and would have no guide but him. She was greatly offended. I believe she never quite forgave me. Such determination to withdraw from the advices and the influence of my friends in spiritual matters produced the consequence that also in my temporal affairs I gained sufficient courage to obey my own persuasions. But for the assistance of my faithful, invisible leader, I could not have prospered here. I am still gratefully astonished at his wise and happy guidance. No one knew how matters stood with me. Even I myself did not know. The thing, the wicked and inexplicable thing, which separates us from the being to whom we owe our life, and in whom all that deserves the name of life must find its nourishment, the thing which we call sin, I yet knew nothing of. In my intercourse with my invisible friend, I felt the sweetest enjoyment of all my powers. My desire of constantly enjoying this felicity was so predominant that I abandoned without hesitation whatever marred our intercourse, and here experience was my best teacher. But it was with me as with sick persons who have no medicine and try to help themselves by diet. Something is accomplished, but far from enough. I could not always live in solitude, though in it I found the best preservative against the dissipation of my thoughts. On returning to the tumult, the impression it produced upon me was the deeper for my previous loneliness. My most peculiar advantage lay in this, that love for quiet was my ruling passion, and that in the end I still drew back to it. I perceived, as in a kind of twilight, my weakness and my misery, and tried to save myself by avoiding danger and exposure. For 7 years I had used my dietetic scheme. I held myself not wicked, and I thought my state desirable. But for some peculiar circumstances and occurrences I had remained in this position. It was by a curious path that I got farther. Contrary to the advice of all my friends, I entered on a new connection. Their objections at first made me pause. I turned to my invisible leader, and as he permitted me, I went forward without fear. A man of spirit, heart, and talents had bought a property beside us. Among the strangers whom I grew acquainted with were this person and his family. In our manners, domestic economy, and habits we accorded well, and thus we soon approximated to each other. Philo, as I proposed to call him, was already middle-aged. In certain matters he was highly serviceable to my father, whose strength was now decaying. He soon became the friend of the family, and finding in me, as he was pleased to say, a person free alike from the extravagance and emptiness of the great world, and from the narrowness and aridness of the still world in the country, he courted intimacy with me, and ere long we were in one another's confidence. To me he was very pleasing and useful. Though I did not feel the smallest inclination or capacity for mingling in public business, or seeking any influence on it, yet I liked to hear about such matters, liked to know whatever happened far and near. Of worldly things I loved to get a clear though unconcerned perception. Feeling, sympathy, affection I reserved for God, for my people, and my friends. The latter were, if I may say so, jealous of Philo in my new connection with him. In more than one sense they were right in warning me about it. I suffered much in secret, for even I could not consider their remonstrances as altogether empty or selfish. I had been accustomed from of old to give a reason for my views and conduct, but in this case my conviction would not follow. I prayed to God that here, as elsewhere, he would warn, restrain, and guide me. And as my heart on this did not dissuade me, I went forward on my way with comfort. Philo, on the whole, had a remote resemblance to Narcisse. Only a pious education had more enlivened and concentrated his feelings. He had less vanity, more character. And in business, if Narcisse was delicate, exact, persevering, indefatigable, the other was clear, sharp, quick, and capable of working with incredible ease. By means of him I learned the secret history of almost every noble personage with whose exterior I had got acquainted in society. It was pleasant for me to behold the tumult off my watch-tower from afar. Philo could now hide nothing from me. he confided to me by degrees his own concerns, both inward and outward. I was in fear because of him, for I foresaw certain circumstances and entanglements, and the mischief came more speedily than I had looked for. There were some confessions he had still kept back, and even at last he told me only what enabled me to guess the worst. What an effect had this upon my heart! I attained experiences which to me were altogether new. With infinite sorrow I beheld an Agathon, who, educated in the groves of Delphi, still owed his school fees, which he was now obliged to pay with their accumulated interest. And this Agathon was my especial friend. My sympathy was lively and complete. I suffered with him. Both of us were in the strangest state. After having long occupied myself with the temper of his mind, I at last turned round to contemplate my own. The thought, "Thou art no better than he," rose like a little cloud before me, and gradually expanded till it darkened all my soul. I now not only thought myself no better than he, I felt this, and felt it as I should not wish to do again, nor was it any transitory mood. For more than a year I was compelled to feel that, had not an unseen hand restrained me, I might have become a Girard, a Cartouche, a Damien, or any wretch you can imagine. The tendencies to this I traced too clearly in my heart. Heavens, what a discovery! If hitherto I had never been able, in the faintest degree, to recognize in myself the reality of sin by experience, its possibility was now become apparent to me by anticipations in the frightfulest manner. And yet I knew not evil. I but feared it. I felt that I might be guilty, and could not accuse myself of being so. Deeply as I was convinced that such a temperament of soul, as I now saw mine to be, could never be adapted for that union with the invisible being which I hoped for after death, I did not in the smallest fear that I should finally be separated from him. With all the wickedness which I discovered in my heart, I still loved him. I hated what I felt, nay, wished to hate it still more earnestly. My whole desire was to be delivered from this sickness, and this tendency to sickness, and I was persuaded that the great physician would at length vouchsafe his help. The sole question was, what medicine will cure this malady? The practice of virtue? This I could not for a moment think. For 10 years I had already practiced more than mere virtue, and the horrors now first discovered had all the while lain hidden at the bottom of my soul. Might they not have broken out with me, as they did with David when he looked on Bathsheba? Yet was not he a friend of God? And was not I assured in my inmost heart that God was my friend? Was it then an unavoidable infirmity of human nature? Must we just content ourselves in feeling and acknowledging the sovereignty of inclination? And, with the best will, is there nothing left for us but to abhor the fault we have committed, and on the like occasion to commit it again? From systems of morality I could obtain no comfort. Neither their severity, by which they try to bend our inclinations, nor their attractiveness, by which they try to place our inclinations on the side of virtue, gave me any satisfaction. The fundamental notions which I had imbibed from intercourse with my invisible friend were of far higher value to me. Once, while I was studying the songs composed by David after that tremendous fall, it struck me very much that he traced his indwelling corruption even in the substance out of which he had been shaped. Yet that he wished to be freed from sin, and that he earnestly entreated for a pure heart. But how was this to be attained? The answer from Scripture I was well aware of, that the blood of Jesus cleanseth us from all sin, was a Bible truth which I had long known. But now for the first time I observed that as yet I had never understood this oft-repeated saying. The questions, what does it mean, how is it to be, were day and night working out their answers in me. At last I thought I saw, as by a gleam of light, that what I sought was to be found in the incarnation of the everlasting Word, by whom all things, even we ourselves, were made, that the Eternal descended as an inhabitant to the depths in which we dwell, which he surveys and comprehends, that he passed through our lot from stage to stage, from conception and birth to the grave, that by this marvellous circuit he again mounted to those shining heights whither we too must rise in order to be happy. All this was revealed to me as in a dawning remoteness. Oh, why must we, in speaking of such things, make use of figures which can only indicate external situations? Where is there in his eyes aught high or deep, aught dark or clear? It is we only that have an under and upper, a night and day. And even for this did he become like us, since otherwise we could have had no part in him. But how shall we obtain a share in this priceless benefit? By faith, the Scripture says. And what is faith? To consider the account of an event as true, what help can this afford me? I must be enabled to appropriate its effects, its consequences. This appropriating faith must be a state of mind peculiar, and to the natural man, unknown. Now, gracious Father, grant me faith, so prayed I once, in the deepest heaviness of heart. I was leaning on a little table where I sat. My tear-stained countenance was hidden in my hands. I was now in the condition in which we seldom are, but in which we are required to be if God is to regard our prayers. Oh, that I could but paint what I felt then! A sudden force drew my soul to the cross where Jesus once expired. It was a sudden force, a pull, I cannot name it otherwise, such as leads our soul to an absent loved one. An approximation which, perhaps, is far more real and true than we imagine. So did my soul approach the Son of Man who died upon the cross. And that instant did I know what faith was. "This is faith," said I, and started up as if half frightened. I now endeavoured to get certain of my feeling, of my view, and shortly I became convinced that my soul had acquired a power of soaring upwards which was altogether new to it. Words fail us in describing such emotions. I could most distinctly separate them from all fantasy. They were entirely without fantasy, without image, yet they gave us just such certainty of their referring to some object as our imagination gives us when it paints the features of an absent lover. When the first rapture was over, I observed that my present condition of mind had formerly been known to me, only I had never felt it in such strength. I had never held it fast, never made it mine. I believe, indeed, every human soul at intervals feels something of it. Doubtless it is this which teaches every mortal that there is a God. With such faculty, wont from of old to visit me now and then, I had hitherto been well content, and had not by a singular arrangement of events that unexpected sorrow weighed upon me for a twelvemonth, had not my own ability and strength on that occasion altogether lost credit with me, I perhaps might have remained content with such a state of matters all my days. But now, since that great moment, I had, as it were, got wings. I could mount aloft above what used to threaten me, as the bird can fly singing and with ease across the fiercest stream, while the little dog stands anxiously baying on the bank. My joy was indescribable, and though I did not mention it to anyone, my people soon observed an unaccustomed cheerfulness in me, and could not understand the reason of my joy. Had I but forever held my peace, and tried to nourish this serene temper in my soul, had I not allowed myself to be misled by circumstances so as to reveal my secret, I might then have been saved once more a long and tedious circuit. As in the previous 10 years of my Christian course, this necessary force had not existed in my soul. I had just been in the case of other worthy people, had helped myself by keeping my fancy always full of images, which had some reference to God, a practice so far truly useful, for noxious images and their baneful consequences are by that means kept away. Often, too, our spirit seizes one or other of these spiritual images, and mounts with it a little way upward, like a young bird fluttering from twig to twig. Images and impressions pointing toward God are presented to us by the institutions of the Church, by organs, bells, singing, and particularly by the preaching of our pastors. Of these I used to be unspeakably desirous. No weather, no bodily weakness could keep me from church. The sound of the Sunday bells was the only thing that rendered me impatient on a sickbed. Our head court chaplain, a gifted man, I heard with great pleasure. His colleagues, too, I liked, and I could pick the golden apple of the word from the common fruit, with which on earthen platters it was mingled. With public ordinances, all sorts of private exercises were combined, and these too only nourished fancy and a finer kind of sense. I was so accustomed to this track, I reverenced it so much, that even now no higher one occurred to me, for my soul has only feelers and not eyes. It gropes but does not see. Ah, that it could get eyes and look! Now again, therefore, I went with a longing mind to sermon. But alas, what happened? I no longer found what I was wont to find. These preachers were blunting their teeth on the shell, while I enjoyed the kernel. I soon grew weary of them, and I had already been so spoiled that I could not be content with the little they afforded me. I required images, I wanted impressions from without, and reckoned it a pure spiritual desire that I felt. Philo's parents had been in connection with the Herrnhuter community. In his library were many writings of Count Zinzendorf's. He had spoken with me more than once, very candidly and clearly on the subject, inviting me to turn over one or two of these treatises, if it were but for the sake of studying a psychological phenomenon. I looked upon the Count and those that followed him as very heterodox, and so the Ebersdorf hymn book, which my friend had pressed upon me, lay unread. However, in this total destitution of external excitements for my soul, I opened the hymn book, as it were, by chance, and found in it, to my astonishment, some songs which actually, though under a fantastic form, appeared to shadow what I felt. The originality and simplicity of their expression drew me on. It seemed to be peculiar emotions expressed in a peculiar way. No school technology suggested any notion of formality or commonplace. I was persuaded that these people felt as I did. I was very happy to lay hold of here and there a stanza in their songs, to fix it in my memory and carry it about with me for days. Since the moment when the truth had been revealed to me, some 3 months had in this way passed on. At last I came to the resolution of disclosing everything to Philo, and asking him to let me have those writings, about which I had now become immoderately curious. Accordingly I did so, notwithstanding there was something in my heart which earnestly dissuaded me. I circumstantially related to him all the story, and as he was himself a leading person in it, and my narrative conveyed the sharpest reprimand on him, he felt surprised and moved to an extreme degree. He melted into tears. I rejoiced, believing that in his mind also a full and fundamental change had taken place. He provided me with all the writings I could require, and now I had excess of nourishment for my imagination. I made rapid progress in the Zinzendorfic mode of thought and speech. And be it not supposed that I am yet incapable of prizing the peculiar turn and manner of the Count. I willingly do him justice. He is no empty fantast. He speaks of mighty truths, and mostly in a bold, figurative style. The people who despise him know not either how to value or discriminate his qualities. At that time I became exceedingly attached to him. Had I been mistress of myself, I would certainly have left my friends and country and gone to join him. We should infallibly have understood each other, and should hardly have agreed together long. Thanks to my better genius, that now kept me so confined by my domestic duties, I reckoned it a distant journey if I visited the garden. The charge of my aged, weakly father afforded me employment enough, and in hours of recreation I had fancy to procure me pastime. The only mortal whom I saw was Philo. He was highly valued by my father, but with me his intimacy had been cooled a little by the late explanation. Its influence on him had not penetrated deep, and as some attempts to talk in my dialect had not succeeded with him, he avoided touching on this subject, and the rather as his extensive knowledge put it always in his power to introduce new topics in his conversation. I was thus a Herrnhut sister on my own footing. I had especially to hide this new turn of my temper and my inclinations from the head court chaplain, whom, as my father confessor, I had much cause to honour, and whose high merits his extreme aversion to the Herrnhut community did not diminish, in my eyes, even then. Unhappily this worthy person had to suffer many troubles on account of me and others. Several years ago he had become acquainted with an upright, pious gentleman residing in a distant quarter, and had long continued in unbroken correspondence with him, as with one who truly sought God. How painful was it to the spiritual leader when this gentleman subsequently joined himself to the community of Herrnhut, where he lived for a long while. How delightful, on the other hand, when at length he quarrelled with the brethren, determined to settle in our neighbourhood, and seemed once more to yield himself completely to the guidance of his ancient friend. The stranger was presented as in triumph by the upper pastor to all the chosen lambs of his fold. To our house alone he was not introduced, because my father did not now see company. The gentleman obtained no little approbation. He combined the polish of the court with the winning manner of the brethren, and having also many fine qualities by nature, he soon became the favourite saint with all who knew him, a result at which the chaplain was exceedingly contented. But alas, it was merely in externals that the gentleman had split with the community. In his heart he was entirely a Herrnhuter. He was in truth concerned for the reality of the matter. But yet the gimcracks, which the Count had stuck round it, were at the same time quite adapted to his taste. Besides, he had now become accustomed to this mode of speaking and conceiving, and if he had to hide it carefully from his old friend, the gladder was he, in any knot of trusty persons, to come forth with his couplets, litanies, and little figures, in which, as might have been supposed, he met with great applause. I knew nothing of the whole affair, and wandered quietly along in my separate path. For a good while we continued mutually unknown. Once in a leisure hour I happened to visit a lady who was sick. I found several acquaintances with her, and soon perceived that my appearance had cut short their conversation. I affected not to notice anything, but saw ere long, with great surprise, some Herrnhut figures stuck upon the wall in elegant frames. Quickly comprehending what had passed before my entrance, I expressed my pleasure at the sight in a few suitable verses. Conceive the wonder of my friends. We explained ourselves. Instantly we were agreed, and in each other's confidence. I often henceforth sought opportunities of going out. Unhappily I found such only once in the 3 or 4 weeks. Yet I grew acquainted with our gentleman apostle, and by degrees with all the body. I visited their meetings when I could. With my social disposition it was quite delightful for me to communicate to others, and to hear from them, the feelings which, till now, I had conceived and harboured by myself. But I was not so completely taken with my friends as not to see that few of them could really feel the sense of those affecting words and emblems, and that from these they drew as little benefit as formerly they did from the symbolic language of the Church. Yet notwithstanding I went on with them, not letting this disturb me. I thought I was not called to search and try the hearts of others. Had not I, too, by long-continued innocent exercisings of that sort, been prepared for something better? I had my share of profit from our meetings. In speaking I insisted on attending to the sense and spirit, which in things so delicate is rather apt to be disguised by words than indicated by them. And for the rest I left with silent tolerance, each to act according to his own conviction. End of section 5. Section 6 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 6, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Confessions of a Fair Saint, Conclusion. These quiet times of secret social joy were shortly followed by storms of open bickering and contradiction. Contentions which excited great commotion, I might almost say occasioned not a little scandal, in court and town. The period was now arrived when our chaplain, that stout gainsayer of the Herrnhut brethren, must discover to his deep, but I trust sanctified humiliation, that his best and once most zealous hearers were now all leaning to the side of that community. He was excessively provoked. In the first moments he forgot all moderation, and could not, even if he had inclined it, retract afterward. Violent debates took place, in which happily I was not mentioned, both as being an accidental member of those hated meetings, and then because, in respect of certain civic matters, our zealous preacher could not safely disoblige either my father or my friend. With silent satisfaction I continued neutral. It was irksome to me to converse about such feelings and objects, even with well-affected people, when they could not penetrate the deepest sense, and lingered merely on the surface. But to strive with adversaries about things on which even friends could scarcely understand each other seemed to me unprofitable, nay, pernicious. For I soon perceived that many amiable noblemen, who on this occurrence could not shut their hearts to enmity and hatred, had rapidly passed over to injustice, and in order to defend an outward form had almost sacrificed their most substantial duties. Far as the worthy clergyman might in the present case be wrong, much as others tried to irritate me at him, I could never hesitate to give him my sincere respect. I knew him well. I could candidly transport myself into his way of looking at these matters. I have never seen a man without his weaknesses. Only in distinguished men they strike us more. We wish, and will at all rates have it, that persons privileged as they are should at the same time pay no tribute, no tax whatever. I honoured him as a superior man, and hoped to use the influence of my calm neutrality to bring about, if not a peace, at least a truce. I know not what my efforts might have done, but God concluded the affair more briefly, and took the chaplain to himself. On his coffin all wept, who had lately been striving with him about words. His uprightness, his fear of God, no one had ever doubted. I too was ere long forced to lay aside this Herrnhut doll work, which, by means of these contentions, now appeared before me in a rather different light. Our uncle had in silence executed his intentions with my sister. He offered her a young man of rank and fortune as a bridegroom, and showed by a rich dowry what might be expected of himself. My father joyfully consented. My sister was free and forewarned. She did not hesitate to change her state. The bridal was appointed at my uncle's castle. Family and friends were all invited, and we came together in the cheerfulest mood. For the first time in my life, the aspect of a house excited admiration in me. I had often heard of my uncle's taste, of his Italian architect, of his collections and his library. But comparing this with what I had already seen, I had formed a very vague and fluctuating picture of it in my thoughts. Great, accordingly, was my surprise at the earnest and harmonious impression which I felt on entering the house, and which every hall and chamber deepened. If elsewhere pomp and decoration had but dissipated my attention, I felt here concentrated and drawn back upon myself. In like manner the preparatives for these solemnities and festivals produced a silent pleasure, by their air of dignity and splendour, and to me it seemed as inconceivable that one man could have invented and arranged all this, as that more than one could have worked together in so high a spirit. Yet, withal, the landlord and his people were entirely natural. Not a trace of stiffness or of empty form was to be seen. The wedding itself was managed in a striking way. An exquisite strain of vocal music came upon us by surprise, and the clergyman went through the ceremony with a singular solemnity. I was standing by Philo at the time, and instead of a congratulation he whispered in my ear, "When I saw your sister give away her hand, I felt as if a stream of boiling water had been poured over me." "Why so?" I inquired. "It is always the way with me," said he, "when I see two people joined." I laughed at him, but I have often since had cause to recollect his words. The revel of the party, among whom were many young people, looked particularly glittering and airy, as everything around us was dignified and serious. The furniture, plate, tableware, and table ornaments accorded with the general whole, and if in other houses you would say the architect was of the school of the confectioner, it here appeared as if even our confectioner and butler had taken lessons from the architect. We stayed together several days, and our intelligent and gifted landlord had variedly provided for the entertainment of his guests. I did not in the present case repeat the melancholy proof which has so often in my life been forced upon me, how unhappily a large mixed company are situated, when, altogether left to themselves, they have to select the most general and vapid pastimes, that the fools of the party may not want amusement, however it may fare with those that are not such. My uncle had arranged it altogether differently. Two or three marshals, if I may call them so, had been appointed by him. One of them had charge of providing entertainment for the young. Dances, excursions, little games were of his invention and under his direction, and as young people take delight in being out of doors and do not fear the influences of the air, the garden and garden hall had been assigned to them, while some additional pavilions and galleries had been erected and appended to the latter, formed of boards and canvas merely, but in such proportions, so elegant and noble, they reminded one of nothing but stone and marble. How rare is a festivity in which the person who invites the guests feels also that it is his duty to provide for their conveniences and wants of every kind. Hunting and card parties, short promenades, opportunities for trustful private conversations were afforded the elder persons, and whoever wished to go earliest to bed was sure to be lodged the farthest from noise. By this happy order the space we lived in appeared to be a little world. And yet, considered narrowly, the castle was not large. Without an accurate knowledge of it, and without the spirit of its owner, it would have been impossible to entertain so many people here, and quarter each according to his humour. As the aspect of a well-formed person pleases us, so also does a fair establishment, by means of which the presence of a rational, intelligent mind is manifested. We feel a joy in entering even a cleanly house, though it may be tasteless in its structure and its decorations, because it shows us the presence of a person cultivated in at least one sense. Doubly pleasing is it, therefore, when, from a human dwelling, the spirit of a higher, though merely sensual culture, speaks to us. All this was vividly impressed on my observation at my uncle's castle. I had heard and read much of art. Philo, too, was a lover of pictures, and had a fine collection. I myself had often practised drawing. But I had been too deeply occupied with my emotions, striving exclusively after the one thing needful, which alone I was bent on carrying to perfection. And then such objects of art as I had hitherto seen appeared, like all other worldly objects, to distract my thoughts. But now, for the first time, outward things had led me back upon myself. I now first perceived the difference between the natural charm of the nightingale's song and that of a four-voiced anthem pealed from the expressive organs of men. My joy over this discovery I did not hide from my uncle, who, when all the rest were settled at their posts, was wont to come and talk with me in private. He spoke with great modesty of what he possessed and had produced here, with great decision of the views in which it had been gathered and arranged, and I could easily observe that he spoke with a forbearance toward me, seeming in his usual way to rate the excellence which he himself possessed below that other excellence which in my way of thinking was the best and properest. "If we can conceive it possible," he once observed, "that the Creator of the world himself assumed the form of his creature, and lived in that manner for a time upon earth, this creature must appear to us of infinite perfection, because susceptible of such a combination with its Maker. Hence in our idea of man there can be no inconsistency with our idea of God. And if we often feel a certain disagreement with him and remoteness from him, it is but the more on that account our duty, not like advocates of the wicked spirit, to keep our eyes continually upon the nakedness and weakness of our nature, but rather to seek out every property and beauty by which our pretension to a similarity with the divinity may be made good." I smiled and answered, "Do not make me blush, dear uncle, by your complaisance in talking in my language. What you have to say is of such importance to me that I wish to hear it in your own most peculiar style, and then what parts of it I cannot quite appropriate I will endeavour to translate." "I may continue," he replied, "in my own most peculiar way, without any alteration of my tone. Man's highest merit always is, as much as possible to rule external circumstances, and as little as possible to let himself be ruled by them. Life lies before us as a huge quarry lies before the architect. He deserves not the name of architect except when, out of this fortuitous mass, he can combine with the greatest economy and fitness and durability some form, the pattern of which originated in his spirit. All things without us, nay, I may add, all things on us, are mere elements. But deep within us lies the creative force, which out of these can produce what they were meant to be, and which leaves us neither sleep nor rest, till in one way or another, without us or on us, that same have been produced. You, my dear niece, have, it may be, chosen the better part. You have striven to bring your moral being, your earnest, lovely nature, into accordance with itself and with the highest. But neither ought we to be blamed when we strive to get acquainted with the sentient man in all his comprehensiveness, and to bring about an active harmony among his powers." By such discoursing we in time grew more familiar, and I begged of him to speak with me as with himself, omitting every sort of condescension. "Do not think," replied my uncle, "that I flatter you when I commend your mode of thinking and acting. I reverence the individual who understands distinctly what it is he wishes, who unweariedly advances, who knows the means conducive to his object, and can seize and use them. How far his object may be great or little, may merit praise or censure, is the next consideration with me. Believe me, love, most part of all the misery and mischief, of all that is denominated evil in the world, arises from the fact that men are too remiss to get a proper knowledge of their aims, and when they do know them, to work intensely in attaining them. They seem to me like people who have taken up a notion that they must and will erect a tower, and who yet expend on the foundation not more stones and labour than would be sufficient for a hut. If you, my friend, whose highest want it was to perfect and unfold your moral nature, had, instead of those bold and noble sacrifices, merely trimmed between your duties to yourself and to your family, your bridegroom, or perhaps your husband, you must have lived in constant contradiction with your feelings, and never could have had a peaceful moment." "You employ the word sacrifice," I answered here, "and I have often thought that to a higher purpose, as to a divinity, we offer up by way of sacrifice a thing of smaller value, feeling like persons who should willingly and gladly bring a favourite lamb to the altar for the health of a beloved father. "Whatever it may be," said he, "reason or feeling, that commands us to give up the one thing for the other, to choose the one before the other, decision and perseverance are, in my opinion, the noblest qualities of man. You cannot have the ware and the money both at the same time. And he who always hankers for the ware without having heart to give the money for it is no better off than he who repents him of the purchase when the ware is in his hands. But I am far from blaming men on this account. It is not they that are to blame. It is the difficult, entangled situation they are in. They know not how to guide themselves in its perplexities. Thus, for instance, you will on the average find fewer bad economists in the country than in towns, and fewer again in small towns than in great. And why? Man is intended for a limited condition. Objects that are simple, near, determinate, he comprehends, and he becomes accustomed to employ such means as are at hand. But on entering a wider field, he now knows neither what he would nor what he should, and it amounts to quite the same whether his attention is distracted by the multitude of objects or is overpowered by their magnitude and dignity. It is always a misfortune for him when he is induced to struggle after anything with which he cannot connect himself by some regular exertion of his powers. Certainly, pursued he, without earnestness there is nothing to be done in life. Yet among the people whom we name cultivated men, little earnestness is to be found. In labours and employments, in arts, nay, even in recreations, they proceed, if I may say so, with a sort of self-defence. They live, as they read a heap of newspapers, only to have done with it. They remind one of that young Englishman at Rome, who said, with a contented air one evening in some company, that today he had dispatched 6 churches and 2 galleries. They wish to know and learn a multitude of things, and precisely those they have the least concern with. And they never see that hunger is not stilled by snapping at the air. When I become acquainted with a man, my first inquiry is, with what does he employ himself, and how, and with what degree of perseverance? The answer regulates the interest I shall take in him for life. "My dear uncle," I replied, "you are perhaps too rigorous. You perhaps withdraw your helping hand from here and there a worthy man to whom you might be useful." "Can it be imputed as a fault," said he, "to one who has so long and vainly laboured on them and about them? How much we have to suffer in our youth from men who think they are inviting us to a delightful pleasure party, when they undertake to introduce us to the Danaides or Sisyphus. Heaven be praised! I have rid myself of these people. If one of them unfortunately comes within my sphere, I forthwith, in the politest manner, compliment him out again. It is from such persons that you hear the bitterest complaints about the miserable course of things, the aridity of science, the levity of artists, the emptiness of poets, and much more of that sort. They do not recollect that they, and the many like them, are the very persons who would never read a book which had been written just as they require it. That true poetry is alien to them, that even an excellent work of art can never gain their approbation except by means of prejudice. But let us now break off, for this is not the time to rail or to complain." He directed my attention to the different pictures hanging on the wall. My eye dwelt on those whose look was beautiful or subject striking. This he permitted for a while. At last he said, "Bestow a little notice on the spirit manifested in these other works. Good minds delight to trace the finger of the deity in nature. Why not likewise pay some small regard to the hand of his imitator?" He then led my observation to some unobtrusive figures, endeavouring to make me understand that it was the history of art alone which could give us an idea of the worth and dignity of any work of art, that we should know the weary steps of mere handicraft and mechanism, over which the man of talents has struggled in the course of centuries, before we can conceive how it is possible for the man of genius to move with airy freedom on the pinnacle whose very aspect makes us giddy. With this view he had formed a beautiful series of works, and whilst he explained it, I could not help conceiving that I saw before me a similitude of moral culture. When I expressed my thought to him, he answered, "You are altogether right, and we see from this that those do not act well who, in a solitary, exclusive manner, follow moral cultivation by itself. On the contrary, it will be found that he whose spirit strives for a development of that kind has likewise every reason, at the same time, to improve his finer sentient powers, that so he may not run the risk of sinking from his moral height by giving way to the enticements of a lawless fancy, and degrading his moral nature by allowing it to take delight in tasteless baubles, if not in something worse." I did not suspect him of levelling at me, but I felt myself struck when I reflected how many insipidities there might be in the songs that used to edify me, and how little favour the figures which had joined themselves to my religious ideas would have found in the eyes of my uncle. Philo, in the meantime, had frequently been busied in the library. He now took me along with him. We admired the selection as well as the multitude of books. They had been collected on my uncle's general principle. There were none to be found among them but such as either lead to correct knowledge or teach right arrangement, such as either give us fit materials or further the concordance of our spirit. In the course of my life I had read very largely. In certain branches there was almost no work unknown to me. The more pleasant was it here to speak about the general survey of the whole, to mark deficiencies, and not, as elsewhere, see nothing but a hampered confusion or a boundless expansion. Here, too, we became acquainted with a very interesting, quiet man. He was a physician and a naturalist. He seemed rather one of the penates than of the inmates. He showed us the museum, which, like the library, was fixed in glass cases to the walls of the chambers, adorning and ennobling the space, which it did not crowd. On this occasion I recalled with joy the days of my youth, and showed my father many of the things he had been wont to lay upon the sick bed of his little child, just opening its little eyes to look into the world then. At the same time the physician, in our present and following conversations, did not scruple to avow how near he approximated to me in respect of my religious sentiments. He warmly praised my uncle for his tolerance, and his esteem of all that testified or forwarded the worth and unity of human nature, admitting also that he called for a similar return from others, and would shun and condemn nothing else so heartily as individual pretension and narrow exclusiveness. Since the nuptials of my sister, joy had sparkled in the eyes of our uncle. He often spoke with me of what he meant to do for her and for her children. He had several fine estates, he managed them himself, and hoped to leave them in the best condition to his nephews. Regarding the small estate where we at present were, he appeared to entertain peculiar thoughts. "I will leave it to none," said he, "but to a person who can understand and value and enjoy what it contains, and who feels how loudly every man of wealth and rank, especially in Germany, is called on to exhibit something like a model to others." Most of his guests were now gone. We, too, were making ready for departure, thinking we had seen the final scene of this solemnity, when his attention in affording us some dignified enjoyment produced a new surprise. We had mentioned to him the delight which the chorus of voices, suddenly commencing without accompaniment of any instrument, had given us at my sister's marriage. We hinted at the same time how pleasant it would be were such a thing repeated. But he seemed to pay no heed to us. The livelier was our surprise when he said one evening, "The music of the dance has died away. Our transitory youthful friends have left us. The happy pair themselves have a more serious look than they had some days ago. To part at such a time, when perhaps we shall never meet again, certainly never without changes, exalts us to a solemn mood, which I know not how to entertain more nobly than by the music you were lately signifying a desire to have repeated." The chorus, which had in the meanwhile gathered strength, and by secret practice more expertness, was accordingly made to sing to us a series of four and of eight voiced melodies, which, if I may say so, gave a real foretaste of bliss. Till then I had only known the pious mode of singing, as good souls practice it, frequently with hoarse pipes, imagining, like wild birds, that they are praising God, while they procure a pleasant feeling to themselves. Or perhaps I had listened to the vain music of concerts, in which you are at best invited to admire the talent of the singer, and very seldom have even a transient enjoyment. Now, however, I was listening to music which, as it originated in the deepest feeling of the most accomplished human beings, was by suitable and practised organs in harmonious unity made again to address the deepest and best feelings of man, and to impress him at that moment with a lively sense of his likeness to the Deity. They were all devotional songs in the Latin language. They sat like jewels in the golden ring of a polished intellectual conversation, and without pretending to edify, they elevated me and made me happy in the most spiritual manner. At our departure he presented all of us with handsome gifts. To me he gave the cross of my order, more beautifully and artfully worked and enamelled than I had ever seen it before. It was hung upon a large brilliant, by which also it was fastened to the chain. This he gave me, he said, as the noblest stone in the cabinet of a collector. My sister, with her husband, went to their estates, the rest of us to our abodes. Appearing to ourselves, so far as outward circumstances were concerned, to have returned to quite an everyday existence. We had been, as it were, dropped from a palace of the fairies down upon the common earth, and were again obliged to help ourselves as we best could. The singular experiences which this new circle had afforded left a fine impression on my mind. This, however, did not long continue in its first vivacity. Though my uncle tried to nourish and renew it by sending me certain of his best and most pleasing works of art, changing them from time to time with others which I had not seen. I had been so much accustomed to be busied with myself in regulating the concerns of my heart and temper, and conversing on these matters with persons of a like mind, that I could not long study any work of art attentively without being turned by it back upon myself. I was used to look at a picture or copper plate merely as the letters of a book. Fine printing pleases well, but who would read a book for the beauty of the printing? In like manner I required of each pictorial form that it should tell me something, should instruct, affect, improve me. And after all my uncle's letters to expound his works of art, say what he would, I continued in my former humour. Yet not only my peculiar disposition, but external incidents and changes in our family, still farther drew me back from contemplations of that nature. Nay, for some time even from myself. I had to suffer and to do more than my slender strength seemed fit for. My maiden sister had till now been as a right arm to me. Healthy, strong, unspeakably good-natured, she had managed all the housekeeping, I myself being busied with the personal nursing of our aged father. She was seized with a catarrh, which changed to a disorder of the lungs. In 3 weeks she was lying in her coffin. Her death inflicted wounds on me, the scars of which I am not yet willing to examine. I was lying sick before they buried her. The old ailment in my breast appeared to be awakening. I coughed with violence, and was so hoarse I could not speak beyond a whisper. My married sister, out of fright and grief, was brought to bed before her time. Our old father thought he was about to lose at once his children and the hope of their posterity. His natural tears increased my sorrow. I prayed to God that he would give me back a sufferable state of health. I asked him but to spare my life till my father should die. I recovered. I was what I reckoned well, being able to discharge my duties, though with pain. My sister was again with child. Many cares which in such cases are committed to the mother, in the present instance fell to me. She was not altogether happy with her husband. This was to be hidden from our father. I was often made judge of their disputes, in which I could decide with the greater safety as my brother trusted in me, and the two were really worthy persons, only each of them, instead of humouring, endeavoured to convince the other, and, out of eagerness to live in constant harmony, never could agree. I now learned to mingle seriously in worldly matters, and to practise what of old I had but sung. My sister bore a son. The frailty of my father did not hinder him from travelling to her. The sight of the child exceedingly enlivened and cheered him. At the christening, contrary to his custom, he seemed as if inspired. Nay, I might say, like a genius with two faces. With the one he looked joyfully forward to those regions which he soon hoped to enter, with the other to the new, hopeful, earthly life which had arisen in the boy descended from him. On our journey home he never wearied talking to me of the child, its form, its health, and his wish that the gifts of this new denizen of earth might be rightly cultivated. His reflections on the subject lasted when we had arrived at home. It was not till some days afterward that I observed a kind of fever in him, which displayed itself, without shivering, in a sort of languid heat commencing after dinner. He did not yield, however. He went out as usual in the mornings, faithfully attending to the duties of his office, till at last continuous serious symptoms kept him within doors. I shall never forget with what distinctness, clearness, and repose of mind he settled in the greatest order the concerns of his house, nay, the arrangements of his funeral, as he would have done a business of some other person. With a cheerfulness which he never used to show, and which now mounted to a lively joy, he said to me, "Where is the fear of death which I once felt? Shall I shrink at departing? I have a gracious God. The grave awakens no terror in me. I have an eternal life." To recall the circumstances of his death, which shortly followed, forms one of the most pleasing entertainments of my solitude. the visible workings of a higher power in that solemn time, no one shall ever argue from me. The death of my beloved father altogether changed my mode of life. From the strictest obedience, the narrowest confinement, I passed at once into the greatest freedom. I enjoyed it like a sort of food from which one has long abstained. Formerly I very seldom spent 2 hours from home. Now I very seldom lived a day there. My friends, whom I had been allowed to visit only by hurried snatches, wished now to have my company without interruption, as I did to have theirs. I was often asked to dinner. At walks and pleasure jaunts I never failed. But when once the circle had been fairly run, I saw that the invaluable happiness of liberty consisted not in doing what one pleases and what circumstances may invite to, but in being able, without hindrance or restraint, to do in the direct way what one regards as right and proper. And in this instance I was old enough to reach a valuable truth, without smarting for my ignorance. One pleasure I could not deny myself. It was, as soon as might be, to renew and strengthen my connection with the Herrnhut brethren. I hastened accordingly to visit one of their establishments at no great distance, but here I by no means found what I had been anticipating. I was frank enough to signify my disappointment, which they tried to soften by alleging that the present settlement was nothing to a full and fitly organized community. This I did not take upon me to deny, yet in my thought the genuine spirit of the matter might have displayed itself in a small body as well as in a great one. One of their bishops, who was present, a personal disciple of the Count, took considerable pains with me. He spoke English perfectly, and as I too understood a little of it, he reckoned this a token that we both belonged to one class. I, however, reckoned nothing of the kind. His conversation did not in the least satisfy me. He had been a cutler, was a native of Moravia. His mode of thought still savoured of the artisan. With Herr von L., who had been a major in the French service, I got upon a better footing. Yet I could never bring myself to the submissiveness he showed to his superiors. Nay, I felt as if you had given me a box on the ear, when I saw the major's wife, and other women more or less like ladies, take the bishop's hand and kiss it. Meanwhile a journey into Holland was proposed, which, however, doubtless for my good, did not take place. My sister had been delivered of a daughter, and now it was the turn of us women to exult, and consider how the little creature should be bred like one of us. The husband, on the other hand, was not so satisfied, when in the following year another daughter saw the light. With his large estates he wanted to have boys about him, who in future might assist him in his management. My health was feeble. I kept myself in peace, and by a quiet mode of life, in tolerable equilibrium. I was not afraid of death, nay, I wished to die, yet I secretly perceived that God was granting time for me to prove my soul, and to advance still nearer to himself. In my many sleepless nights, especially, I have at times felt something which I cannot undertake to describe. It was as if my soul were thinking separately from the body. She looked upon the body as a foreign substance, as we look upon a garment. She pictured with extreme vivacity events and times long past, and felt, by means of this, events that were to follow. Those times are all gone by. What follows likewise will go by. The body, too, will fall to pieces like a vesture. But I, the well-known I am. The thought is great, exalted, and consoling. Yet an excellent friend, with whom I every day became more intimate, instructed me to dwell on it as little as I could. This was the physician whom I met in my uncle's house, and who had since accurately informed himself about the temper of my body and my spirit. He showed me how much these feelings, when we cherish them within us independently of outward objects, tend, as it were, to excavate us, and to undermine the whole foundation of our being. To be active, he would say, is the primary vocation of man. All the intervals in which he is obliged to rest, he should employ in gaining clearer knowledge of external things. For this will in its turn facilitate activity. This friend was acquainted with my custom of looking on my body as an outward object. He knew also that I pretty well understood my constitution, my disorder, and the medicines of use for it. Nay, that by continual sufferings of my own or other people's, I had really grown into a kind of half-doctor. He now carried forward my attention from the human body, and the drugs which act upon it, to the kindred objects of creation. He led me up and down as in the paradise of the first man. only if I may continue my comparison, allowing me to trace, in dim remoteness, the Creator walking in the garden in the cool of the evening. How gladly did I now see God in nature, when I bore him with such certainty within my heart! How interesting to me was his handiwork! How thankful did I feel that he had pleased to quicken me with the breath of his mouth! We again had hopes that my sister would present us with a boy. Her husband waited anxiously for that event, but did not live to see it. He died in consequence of an unlucky fall from horseback, and my sister followed him soon after she had brought into the world a lovely boy. The four orphans they had left I could not look at but with sadness. So many healthy people had been called away before poor, sickly me. Might I not also have blights to witness among these fair and hopeful blossoms? I knew the world sufficiently to understand what dangers threatened the precarious breeding of a child, especially a child of quality. And it seemed as if, since the period of my youth, these dangers had increased. I felt that, weakly as I was, I could not be of much, perhaps of any, service to the little ones. And I rejoiced the more on finding that my uncle, as indeed might have been looked for, had determined to devote his whole attention to the education of these amiable creatures. And this they doubtless merited in every sense. They were handsome, and with great diversities all promised to be well-conditioned, reasonable persons. Since my worthy doctor had suggested it, I loved to trace out family likenesses among our relatives and children. My father had carefully preserved the portraits of his ancestors, and got his own and those of his descendants drawn by tolerable masters. Nor had my mother and her people been forgotten. We accurately knew the characters of all the family, and as we had frequently compared them with each other, we now endeavoured to discover in the children the same peculiarities outward or inward. My sister's eldest son, we thought, resembled his paternal grandfather, of whom there was a fine youthful picture in my uncle's collection. He had been a brave soldier, and in this point, too, the boy took after him, liking arms above all things, and busying himself with them whenever he paid me a visit. For my father had left a very pretty armoury, and the boy got no rest till I had given him a pair of pistols and a fowling-piece, and he had learned the proper way of using them. At the same time, in his conduct or bearing, there was nothing like rudeness. Far from that, he was always meek and sensible. The eldest daughter had attracted my especial love, of which perhaps the reason was that she resembled me, and of all the four seemed to like me best. But I may well admit that, the more closely I observed her as she grew, the more she shamed me. I could not look on her without a sentiment of admiration, nay, I may almost say, of reverence. You would scarcely have seen a nobler form, a more peaceful spirit, an activity so equable and universal. No moment of her life was she unoccupied, and every occupation in her hands became dignified. All seemed indifferent to her, so that she could but accomplish what was proper in the place and time. And in the same manner, she could patiently continue unemployed when there was nothing to be done. This activity without need of occupation I have never elsewhere met with. In particular, her conduct to the suffering and destitute was, from her earliest youth, inimitable. For my part, I freely confess, I never had the gift to make a business of beneficence. I was not niggardly to the poor, nay, I often gave too largely for my means, yet this was little more than buying myself off, and a person needed to be made for me if I was to bestow attention on him. Directly the reverse was the conduct of my niece. I never saw her give a poor man money. Whatever she obtained from me for this purpose, she failed not in the first place to change for some necessary article. Never did she seem more lovely in my eyes than when rummaging my clothes presses. She was always sure to light on something which I did not wear and did not need. To sew these old cast-off articles together and put them on some ragged child, she thought her highest happiness. Her sister's turn of mind appeared already different. She had much of her mother. She promised to become very elegant and beautiful, and she now bids fair to keep her promise. She is greatly taken up with her exterior. From her earliest years she could decorate and carry herself in a way that struck you. I still remember with what ecstasy, when quite a little creature, she saw herself in a mirror, decked in certain precious pearls, once my mother's, which she had by chance discovered, and made me try upon her. Reflecting on these diverse inclinations, it was pleasant for me to consider how my property would, after my decease, be shared among them, and again called into use. I saw the fowling pieces of my father once more travelling around the fields on my nephew's shoulder, and birds once more falling from his hunting pouch. I saw my whole wardrobe issuing from the church, at Easter confirmation, on the persons of tidy little girls, while the best pieces of it were employed to decorate some virtuous burgher maiden on her marriage day. In furnishing such children and poor little girls, Natalia had a singular delight, though, as I must here remark, she showed not the smallest love, or, if I may say it, smallest need, of a dependence upon any visible or invisible being, such as I had in my youth so strongly manifested. When I also thought that the younger sister, on that same day, would wear my jewels and pearls at court, I could see with peace my possessions, like my body, given back to the elements. The children waxed apace. To my comfort, they are healthy, handsome, clever creatures. That my uncle keeps them from me, I endure without repining. When staying in the neighbourhood or even in town, they seldom see me. A singular personage, regarded as a French clergyman, though no one rightly knows his history, has been entrusted with the oversight of all these children. He has them taught in various places. They are put to board now here, now there. At first I could perceive no plan whatever in this mode of education, till at last our doctor told me the abbé had convinced my uncle that, in order to accomplish anything by education, we must first become acquainted with the pupil's tendencies and wishes, that, these once ascertained, he ought to be transported to a situation where he may, as speedily as possible, content the former and attain the latter, and so, if he have been mistaken, may still in time perceive his error, and at last, having found what suits him, may hold the faster by it, may the more diligently fashion himself according to it. I wish this strange experiment may prosper. With such excellent natures it is, perhaps, possible. But there is one peculiarity in these instructors which I never shall approve of. They study to exclude the children from whatever might awaken them to an acquaintance with themselves and with the invisible, sole, faithful friend. I often take it ill of my uncle that on this account he considers me dangerous for the little ones. Thus in practice there is no man tolerant. Many assure us that they willingly leave each to take his own way, yet all endeavour to seclude from action every one that does not think as they do. This removal of the children troubles me the more I am convinced of the reality of my belief. How can it fail to have a heavenly origin, an actual object, when in practice it is so effectual? Is it not by practice alone that we prove our own existence? Why then may we not, by a like mode, prove to ourselves the influence of that power who gives us all good things? That I am still advancing, never retrograding, that my conduct is approximating more and more to the image I have formed of perfection, that I every day feel more facility in doing what I reckon proper, even while the weakness of my body so obstructs me. Can all this be accounted for upon the principles of human nature, whose corruption I have so clearly seen into? For me, at least, it cannot. I scarcely remember a commandment. To me there is nothing that assumes the aspect of law. It is an impulse that leads me and guides me always aright. I freely follow my emotions, and know as little of constraint as of repentance. God be praised that I know to whom I am indebted for such happiness, and that I cannot think of it without humility. There is no danger I should ever become proud of what I myself can do or can forbear to do. I have seen too well what a monster might be formed and nursed in every human bosom, did not higher influence restrain us. End of section 6.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. so you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.